Welcome to 80s Music Exposed, the podcast in which we review all the best albums of the 80s, one month at a time. We will break them down, give you the skinny, and duke it out over whether you should or should not dig these back out again. If you are ready for an 80s music deep dive, from Public Enemy to Wham, Eno to XTC, Madonna, hair metal, reggae, and all points in between, then crank the boombox, turn the Walkman up to 10, and ooh, let's go. Now, from the kitchen, Chris and Henry.
Welcome to 80s Music Exposed. I'm Henry.
And I'm Chris.
And it's like almost Christmas.
It is. We're right up
I mean, it's not really Christmas. It's like August of 1981 in our mind. Right?
Yes. Episode-wise, we're in the middle of the summer. Hot town, summer in the city. But in reality, it's dark early.
Mm-hmm. We're looking out our window here in beautiful uptown Charlotte, North Carolina.
The week before Christmas.
Nice Christmas tree.
Have you heard, there. Henry, I noticed this a lot in the shops when, you know, everything switched over to Christmas music. Mm-hmm. Do you ever walk into a store and you hear one of those songs that you know is from that album, that alternative Christmas album that came out like in
only
the early 90s?
Only when anything goes like...
Do you remember, you know, the album I'm talking about? It's got... Got the Cocteau Twins doing Frosty the Snowman.
Is that on that record?
Yep, it's a compilation. It's got it was called The Edge of Christmas.
And who was on it?
Let's look this up.
The Cocteau Twins were on it?
The Edge of Christmas, Queen, Thank God It's Christmas, Pat Benatar, Please Come Home
for
Christmas.
That's not edgy. That's
the
not
Pretenders,
alternative.
2,000 Mile.
I mean.
Kate Bush, December Will Be Magic Again.
Okay.
David Bowie and Bing Crosby, Peace on Earth.
Yeah.
Cocteau Twins, Winter Wonderland. Okay. The Smithereens, Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Dave Edmonds, Run, Run, Rudolph. The Paolas, Christmas is Coming. The Pogues, Fairy Tale of New York.
Uh-huh. Really?
The Ramones, Merry Christmas, I Don't Want to Fight, and the Waitresses, Christmas Wrapping.
Who thought that was a good idea? Hey, we're going to do a Christmas album, because when you think of Christmas, you really need that edge.
It's the edge, man. You want the edge. This is going to be an episode, Henry, where we're going to skip plugs at the top.
Okay.
Why don't we say that? If you need to know how we rate and review and how we pick the records, you can find it from an earlier episode. I guess, Henry, give him your Twitter handle.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Hank G, HANKGEE.
Right, and mine is at TCI Duke.
We do want to thank our supporters, though. We've got a really solid group of listeners that follow us from episode to episode, despite like any gaps. And I just want to say I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for sticking with us. And because this is a double episode, this is the second episode of August 1981, we don't have any significant events because I don't know, Henry, if you remember last episode, we had some serious, August had some serious significant events for the decade of the 80s, but we don't want to have to cover those again. So I thought we might cover some current events. I just got back from London.
Yeah, so like we've listened to some records that, I mean, have some London origins, right?
Yeah, and the one I probably that's relevant for this trip was I went to, they had an exhibit at the London Museum for the record, the album London Calling by The Clash.
So our listeners will want to know about that.
Yeah, probably. Definitely. It was pretty interesting. It never occurred to me that the bass that was being bashed by Paul Simonon, right, on the cover of that album, and the photographer, there's a little cutout piece where he's like so happy that he got that shot. That actual bass, all broken up in pieces, was a part of the exhibit, which I thought was really cool.
So somebody grabbed that bass and immediately saved it?
Yeah, and he never, I guess, never put it back together because it's broken into like three pieces, which is really, he really went for it with that. Then they had a lot of the sheet where the lyrics were written out. They had a lot of... because a lot of the record, I didn't know this, was written in the studio. So they rehearsed for like 3 weeks and wrote all these songs and then put them down.
And they had the notes right there.
Had the notes.
I guess Joe Strummer's writing.
Yeah, most of it was Joe Strummer's. And they said it was on loan from his estate. So it definitely was the real stuff.
So how was it just concentrated on like London Calling stuff, or was there other stuff in there?
It was mostly focused on the album London Calling. So it had their outfits from the shows that went along with that tour and the sheet music, you know, not the sheet music, but the lyric sheets from where they'd written the songs and some, you know, the instrument and then all those, all that footage where you could put headphones on and watch them rehearsing in the studio.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And listen to it.
Like right from the board?
Like right from the board.
That'd be cool.
And you heard a lot of the songs in there raw as there's, because they're literally just standing around together, like holding guitars, trying to write these songs, just standing there doing.
So we didn't review London Calling, right? That came out in 79.
79, right before.
We got the follow-up after that.
That's right.
At least on
Sandinista.
Sandinista, right,
yes.
After that. But, okay, we did review McCartney.
Yes.
And, yeah, of course, you went to Abbey Road.
I did go to Abbey Road.
What's that like?
Very touristy because, obviously, you know, the album cover. So everyone's trying to get their picture taken crossing Abbey Road.
Is there a place?
Like, so, I wanted to ask people, like 20-somethings, I wanted to ask them, like, you know, that obviously were, like, not Beatles fans, like, walking across trying to get it. I'm like, come on. Name one song on Abbey Road. But I didn't, you know.
So they said Abbey Road.
Yeah. Abbey Road. So, shut the fuck up and go home.
You can cross the street, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to take that picture, do you have to go out in the middle of the intersection?
If you want to do it right, like if you want to do the picture from the perspective of the album cover, you got to get out in the middle of the street.
And there's nobody, surely there has to be some cop or something
nope.
saying, nope, you can't come out here
nope.
in the middle of the street.
Nope. And they're fine. There's nobody around like telling you not to. And the cars, all the people are obviously like, no, so they're real nice about it, but it's a busy. It was way busier than I thought.
You mean it's not like some guy's going to be like, I've had it with these fucking people.
I mean, there was a couple people that weren't as nice as probably they should be, but it wasn't any different than what you would see here, like at one of those pedestrian crossings where you're supposed to stop when a pedestrian comes up.
I see it as like a war of.
It was kind of interesting. I thought it would be like more, like there would be a cop there who would stop and let everybody do their pictures and then let the traffic go.
I would think it's not like anybody go with their, like the socks on cocks, like the other guys.
No, I thought about that too. Like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah.
Anyway.
Henry, I also wanted to talk about something else that I know bugs you.
Yeah. I saw bullet point number two, man. What the fuck are you talking about, Cam?
Well, you know, if you listen to the last episode, I put a couple albums that to me were 80s canon.
Yeah.
And Henry really hates the
whole concept.
Well, I actually went back and culled from all of our episodes what I think is 80s canon.
You put a list on
I made a list of 80s canon.
Yeah. So can you define again what 80s canon means?
So to me, 80s canon is it is a must to fully experience the music of the 1980s. These are must listen. These are holy grail type albums that fully realize what the 80s was. So if all you take away from our tour, our survey of 80s music, is you're like, man, I need to distill this down to the absolute must listens. That's what the 80s canon is.
All right. What do you got?
So far, let me ask you this. How many do you think so far, in 18 months of...
I'd say you probably have about 15.
11.
Oh. 11. I was close.
Yeah. So this is what I consider 80s canon. This is must listen if you're playing along at home.
And okay.
You need homework.
A must listen.
Face Value by Phil Collins.
Wrong.
Beauty and the Beat by the Go-Go's.
Right.
Escape by Journey.
I don't know about that.
Pretenders and Pretenders 2 by The Pretender. Computer World by Kraftwerk.
Yes.
Melted Face by Peter Gabriel.
Yes.
The Game by Queen.
Really?
Closer by Joy Division. Back in Black by AC/DC. Scary Monsters by David Bowie. Dirty Minds by Prince. And Double Fantasy by John Lennon.
So
now here's a quiz. I see with this look on your face. I don't necessarily have to love this record for it to be 80s canon. I'm not a big fan of the Game.
So I think I might have misunderstood what you're saying. Like you would posit that there are records that typify that era. So much so that it reverberated
If a Martian right. comes down and says, I need to know what is 80s music, mm-hmm. popular cultural music, this is my list.
Definitive moments.
Definitive.
Right.
Canon. It's the canon, dude.
I don't like the word, but definitive. But like all those records have a distinct.
Yes. I see what you're saying. So there are records that I like much better than some of these,
right.
like Rush's Moving Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's distinctly 80s canon. I don't think you need to hear that to understand 80s music. So I left it off. There's other albums on here that I could tell you would probably be like, this is way better record. Tom Petty, the Tom Petty record.
Mm-hmm. But it's not.
It's not 80s.
But you would say it doesn't typify this period, that would be more of a timeless record.
That's right. Exactly. Right. So this is my list of 80s canon.
Or you'd say records that are locked in time.
Right.
And maybe
in a small, strange way, it's a knock on the record a little bit.
Yeah, I hear you.
But at the same time, to me, it is a must listen.
You put Dirty Mind in there.
Yeah, Dirty Minds, I think, is must listen for early 80s.
I can see what you're talking about.
But I will, folks, just to annoy Henry, but also for your sake, I will always let you know when I come up upon an album that is canon.
He'll have a little tiny C on everyone else, like when you're on the menu and they suggest something.
Well, you never know.
A little C.
You never know, Henry. Let's get into these albums. Maybe there's a canon album in this episode.
Let's get to some album reviews, man.
Let's do it. All right. The first one we're going to listen to is by Art Garfunkel.
Whoa.
Without Simon.
You jumped right in it. I was wondering when you put this together, I was like, Jesus.
Let's go for it.
We couldn't do that. Okay.
This is Scissors Cut. It was a Rolling Stone 5-star album at the time, and the song we're going to listen to is called Hang On It. Sorry, Hang On In.
As you know, I have always proclaimed myself a fan of Art Garfunkel.
You sure have.
And I believe you put this at the top just to go ahead and pull me out. Right? Just go ahead and get me out of the bushes and into the open to make me – to you know, just to let everybody take their shots. Right?
Yeah, I figured you were going to go whole hog on me about my canon stuff. So I was like, let's just throw Art Garfunkel in Henry's face right
off
the bat.
Let me go ahead and
– Yep.
And shame him. You know, my passionate defense of Art Garfunkel really comes from listening to Simon and Garfunkel as a kid.
And I think I want to get into that, but let's do a little – give us some background, Henry, for this particular record.
What do you mean?
Well, I guess coming to it, I didn't know he even put out a record.
That's the thing. I haven't even listened to any of it. This is the first solo album I've ever listened to this guy. It's his fifth one.
Yeah, so let's give some of that background. It's his fifth solo record. It came out in 1981. Apparently, he had done a couple of solo records, and then he went off to do some acting in films.
I didn't know about the acting part.
I knew him more as an actor from this time period than I did any music he had done. But he was doing some movies. I guess in his mind, and this was an interesting thing I was hoping we could talk about, He openly does not consider himself a songwriter at all.
Yeah.
So until he gets a batch of songs put together by somebody that he felt was worthy of doing, He's just like, I'm going to go do movies.
Like, apparently Jimmy Webb. Like, right. He had a real hard-on for Jimmy Webb.
I guess in a weird way. I mean, I've always thought of him, especially from the acting, as being a walking ego. But for him just to be like, you know, I don't write songs at all.
Yeah. You know you called him pubic head, right?
I still think of that. I can't help it. He looks like a big, like a little penis trying to jut out of the pubic head.
If you're going to insult the guy. Look at the album cover. Listeners, look at the Scissors Cut album cover.
You'll never be able to think of it any other way.
You can't fit that enormous cranium on the fucking page.
Well, I guess I need to try to
his heed.
I need to try to lasso myself back into just this album, but there's a lot I could talk about with Art Garfunkel.
I know.
So this came out also, just for some context, this came out right before what I actually remember Garfunkel for, which was this concert in Central Park.
Right.
Which to me happened right around the same time in my memory, but I guess it did right after this.
Well,
he and Paul Simon got back together, did these concerts in Central Park, which I don't know if you remember, Henry, but I remember seeing them on TV and thinking, how are there that many fucking people in the world at a concert?
Because you saw pictures of it on TV.
Yeah, and you were just like, look at the amount of people out there. And then you're like, you were like, of course, I was like, for these assholes? Like, what?
Well, I was barely even, I mean, I knew they were big, but I wasn't the fan. Like, I wasn't a learned fan like I am now. I just knew, wow, Simon and Garfunkel played Central Park. And I did somehow know that it was a comeback.
Right.
I knew they'd had a falling out, but I didn't know anything about this record we're listening
to. Well, that's the other interesting part. So what I knew of them at the time was not just that they'd had a falling out, but I thought they actually hated each other. So you could see that there was some ego issues there, but let's talk about this record. So my first impression, Henry, again, not knowing that this record really even existed, man, it was weird. I put it on and it was fucking weird.
When you say fucking weird, is this like in a good way or a bad way?
I'm not sure yet. I think maybe at some points I was really digging it and at some points I was not digging it. But I think I texted you this. To me, it sounded like Scott Walker meets Bob Welch.
I understood only on a weird sort of subatomic level what you mean by Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to mention Scott Walker later.
Okay, so to me, Scott Walker means man out of time.
Scott Walker
doesn't sound like anybody else or any particular time except himself.
So
this was almost like these songs are like, dude, what 1981 are you living in? Right. Like, what's going on in your world?
As I did a little research, I started feeling bad because I know that around about this time or right after this, his girlfriend killed herself, and then he went into
that's another interesting point. There's a picture of her, a partial picture of her on the back of the album.
Yeah.
She committed suicide in his apartment while he was filming a movie, I believe right prior to making this record.
God dang.
And he came home. And
so did he
actually said in a quote that he had lost the will to live without her.
Yeah.
But he dedicated this record to her, but I don't know if any of the songs are about her because he didn't write any of these songs.
Here's what I came away with after listening to this with an open mind. The truth is that feels right. I think I like the word funk. Garfunk does have an amazing voice.
Wonderful voice.
But that in and of itself does not make something good per se. I mean, we've seen this many times. Like a good I think his intimate voice worked as a good counterpoint to your point, like you said earlier, like it's a good counterpoint to Simon's work, right?
But I also think, and it's another interesting question, I also think I would like this record better if I thought he had wrote all those songs.
I wrote that down. Because I said Garfunk didn't write any of these. It always kicks the album down the appreciation scale
for me. Yeah,
somehow.
Me too. I have a problem with artists that don't write the material.
Right.
In general. I guess Barbara Streisand's Guilty record is the shining example the other way to me, because...
But that's, I mean, you make the case that that's really a Barry Gibb album.
Right, but that, but that's what I'm saying. I really liked that album, and she didn't write any of it. But then again, and then I think, well, she's an extraordinary talent, but he has a great voice. So Art has a great voice.
Right, you can't say that the stuff is objectively bad, but it comes across as very saccharine.
But wouldn't I don't know. Say? I don't know. The weird thing is then you're like sitting there saying, what type of songs was this dude looking for? Like, these songs are not what you're like. I could not put this anywhere near 80s canon. I don't know what this is. Like, I don't know where these songs come from.
Also, you're used to the mixture of Simon and Garfunkel's voice. That was.
But this didn't even sound. I don't know about you, Henry, but this didn't even sound to me like Simon and Garfunkel. There was one song on here that I was like.
It sounded like half of them.
That's kind of like Simon and Garfunkel. But there's not a lot of the of folky acoustic stuff on here. There's like,
look,
You know what it sounds like, Henry? A lot of this sounds like soundtrack music for bad porno from back in that day.
A little bit, a little cheese ball
with the strings kind of, and the whole like, lilting choruses.
I'm not sure I got this, but I definitely got this. Just how do I say this for the podcast? I mean, only, you know, our listeners. All, you know, several thousand of them will hear me say this, and I don't. It's just kind of creepy sounding. Didn't you find it a little creepy?
Then again, I kept coming back to this record. It was interesting to me, and like I said, I don't know if I don't like it or like it. So I'm not going to recommend it.
I just feel like he's the kind of guy that gets on everybody's nerves.
He is an asshole, I think, from everything I can tell. I just keep coming back to I wanted to not like this record. Everything about this record was screaming for me not to like it. And for some reason, I keep going back to it. It's weird. Maybe in a good way. I don't know.
And I'm supposed to be the fan.
I know. I thought you were really going to make an ardent defense of this record.
I can't. It made me feel kind of creepy.
Yeah, it makes you feel like that. That feeling you got when you were a kid, like maybe your underwear was sticking out.
A little bit.
Or you had a wedgie.
Exactly.
As far as Scissors Cut, Henry, I'm assuming you were not
going to. I'm a thumbs down on this.
You're a thumbs down. Okay. Yeah. I'm not a thumbs down. I'm not going to recommend it. I'm just going
to
say.
I am so interested in your reaction to this.
It makes my butthole tingle. And not in a good way, but I don't know. Something about it. I don't know. I gotta think on it more. Henry, so tell us what our next record is.
The next record is, okay, this is the Replacements. The record we listened to is Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash. This is just, you know, shit we like. We're going to play part of a track on there called Hanging Downtown.
I remember. Ready?
It's about deep, everything is swell. Come on down, come on, what the hell? Oh, I know it better, but you need a whole lot to see when you're hanging down time. Wait, take, no, I can't go. I gotta stick around, watch my show. And horrors, liquor stores, Seventh Street, Sixth Street, bus stop, bus stop, bus stop, bus stop.
Anyway. This is another record, Henry. Like, the Replacements are, for you, they are.
Well, I mean, they're royalty, right?
Yeah, they're royalty in the same breath as Simon and Garfunkel.
I suppose I interviewed Tommy Stinson for our other podcast, the No GD Band podcast.
You did.
Episode number 18, if anybody's interested.
You did. And this is the debut album from the Replacements.
Right.
What are your thoughts, Henry, right off the
bat? It's hard to judge it.
Had you listened to it? In a while, like did it
had been a while. I probably hadn't listened to it in 2, maybe 3 years.
Okay,
I'm interested in what your thoughts are.
So I never listened to this one much. And so going back and listening to it, it was interesting to me because I have always thought of the Replacements as master songwriters. Paul Westerberg, a master songwriter.
Yeah.
What I really liked about this record was, to me, it sounded like, oh, the Replacements, a great pop band who had a bit of an edge to them, who really wanted to be Husker Du in the beginning. And guess what? No matter how much you try to hide it, you're a master pop band. Yeah. So it sounded to me like a hardcore album written by people that don't know how to do hardcore.
Yeah, well, there was like a from what I've read,
which was very interesting.
There were at least 10 bands that did that kind of shit back then.
Well, it sounded to me, I know on the scene that they were in, and obviously they even do an homage to Husker Du.
That Du song?
Yeah, they really were.
Do Something or something?
Yeah, Do Something, I believe. They were trying really hard to fit in with the Minneapolis scene. And you know what this reminded me of in a different way? The first Police record, I think we talked about this, the Police were trying to fit in on the punk scene, and they were not.
Right.
Punk.
Bob Stinson was a prog rock fanatic.
Right. And Paul Westerberg, God bless him, is just such a good songwriter that these songs, you can hear the pop song wanting to come out.
Yeah.
There's a lot of energy.
Right. But a lot of energy is probably an understatement.
Yeah.
It's they're 20 years old and you can feel it coursing through their veins and coming out their fingertips.
Right.
It's frenetic and jarring. And, one thing about that, Chris Marrs could fucking play.
Yes.
Really play. Somehow they got to be punk, but at the same time be very competent at what they're doing.
Well, and I feel like I think after this record, to me, they just said, fuck it. Like, we just do what we do.
Right.
And stop. This is the only record where I consciously feel like I hear them going, oh, we really want to be this thing on this scene. And they were not giving themselves credit for being their own thing. The other problem I have with this record is knowing what's about to come,
that's the
hardest
thing.
Really recommend this. This is the worst Replacements record in my mind.
And to me, this really goes.
And that sounds bad.
Yeah. The hard thing about it is like the reasons people listen to me, should you listen to it because it's objectively good, or should you listen to it because it is a historical stepping stone to what you're going to know later? We got 7 other records with a distinctive progression. Say what you will about it. Like some people will say, like your hardcore Matt's guys will probably say, this is it. Everything after Sorry My Take Out the Trash was a sellout.
Yeah. And then I know there's going to be some, and I think me and you've always disagreed on this. There's going to be some records, the next couple, 2 or 3 that I think are good. But like to me, the end product at the very end of their career, when it was almost just a Paul Westerberg solo.
Yeah.
To me, that is, the amazing work.
Yeah.
That's the stuff where it's like, holy shit, he's inventing a whole new genre of music.
And I really want to leave some space for Megan to talk about this because, you know, this is her band. Sure. Like this is, you know, this is her bumper music are these guys. I think the album does prove that they were top to bottom great. To be fair, it is not their best.
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's their, to be fair, it's their worst.
But someone could argue it. You know, like you could really argue it.
Yes. I do want to say something else that I picked up on it that I thought was very interesting because again, it goes to the point you're making where it's like, these guys are so good. I can hear the sloppiness.
Right.
And it's almost like on purpose, but it's like, this is becoming their trade. Like they're turning sloppiness into a fucking art form. You can hear it.
Years ago, we talked about this and I said, man, if we could only be as good as the Replacements and know how to just play sloppy. And you were like, well, you got to know when. You know, you really do. You got to know when the sloppiness is rock and roll and when the sloppiness is not.
Well, and I think they could do it without talking about it.
The Replacements didn't have musical chops limitations. They may have had other problems like alcoholism or that may have hurt them career-wise
later. Well, they're also a band that I think makes it very interesting, Henry, is their problem was they thought backwards. They didn't want to be great musicians. They really wanted to be shitty, sloppy, hardcore guys, and they were too good to be that. It was almost like the reverse. They had the reverse problem. I almost feel sometimes like Paul Westerberg wishes he didn't know how to write a song. Like sometimes I feel like he's trying hard to just like, this is just a shitty song that just came right off the top of my head. Yeah, and it's great.
Yeah.
Well, fuck you. I don't want it to be that.
So, I mean, those are the arguments that I can make. If you're interested in just like what were the raw materials of how the band turned out, then listen to this. Oh, I do want to mention one other thing. This might get cut out. I think some of what when I listened to this, they put out that remixed version of "Don't Tell a Soul." Have you heard this yet?
No.
The Replacements did this thing called Dead Man's Pop, which is basically they took Don't Tell a Soul and had Matt Wallace remix it based on the original idea, not the Tom Lord Alge remix that sort of neutered it in a lot of people's minds. And to me, and I bet to Megan Maddox, who was probably going to listen to it, that she liked the original version equally as much. I'm like, this is a much better album.
Oh, really?
Much better than the other one.
The new.
Unbelievably better.
Wow. I'll have to check
it's like
that
a
out
whole
then.
Lost, for me, is a whole Lost Replacements album that should have been.
Well, anyway, I would be interested to hear it. I would have thought you would have gone with the original just off the top of my head.
Nope. It squashes it like a grape to me. Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, Henry, our next record is going to be by a band called Japan.
Okay.
And the name of the album is Tin Drum. And the song we're going to play is Ghosts. I do this show for. So when I saw Japan on the sheet, I thought this was gonna be a metal band. I thought this was like a metal band called Tokyo or something. So I was like, oh, I kept putting it off. I was like, I don't want to listen. This is gonna be one of these shitty glam rock metal.
Did you band. Really? Are you for real?
Yeah. And so I didn't know anything about Japan. I put this on, and I'm like, holy fuck. This first of all, I was like, this is not heavy metal glam rock. But then I was like, you know what this sounds like to me? This sounds like exactly what in my mind I always wanted Oingo Boingo to sound like.
Like what Oingo Boingo
should sound like. This was great. I like this record a lot. It's got that weird like experimental sound that only the early 80s had. Like so, it sounds like nothing.
Yeah, so it turns out Japan is not a metal band. They were a new wave, but Japan was a new wave band that was formed in 1974. They weren't always new wave though.
Be careful with this because they don't like this. They don't like this road you're going down.
They were initially a glam rock inspired band.
they were also to hear them tell it, to hear David Sylvain, who is the founder, tell it. Mm-hmm. They were New Romantic before there was a New Romantic. New Romantic just happened to catch up to them, and they didn't like New Romantic because they were like, those people wore suits and fashion because it was a thing, a look. That's just how we fucking dressed. So he really hated New Romantic music, which I was shocked me because
I didn't know that.
They like kind of invented it. But yeah, so apparently right when all that caught up to them, because they you know, all my research now tells me that they were like these, they started the New Romantic movement. When that stuff started getting big, ABC and those kind of bands, they quit.
So
they were right on the cusp of like,
isn't that weird? Like,
and I would probably know them now if they'd have kept doing
that
it.
That record went to number 12. All right, so let's just go ahead and tell the listeners. I mean, we both love this, I'm sure.
I really like this record. It is weird and fun and
I mean, talk about Scott Walker.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
and I heard some Sparks in there too.
And I heard some Roxy Music.
Definitely. And you know what else I heard? And this maybe tarnished it a little bit. They were kind of mining the same territory that Bowie was going down at the time.
Yes.
But I think Bowie gets all the credit.
I can't believe this record went to number 12 because it sounds like an art rock record.
It is an art rock record.
So, well, yeah. But when I say it sounds like it was, I'm surprised it reached number 12.
Right. And it is their most popular record. But they were close to done at this point. And I think what I really liked about them doing research was they look every. If you just look at them, you're like, well, these guys wanted to rule the world at the time. They didn't. They didn't give a shit about anything.
That's so weird. It's a test. How many different sounds you could get out of synths, really?
Because there was literally,
I didn't hear any guitar.
Okay, so that's the other thing. So prior to this album, they had another member who'd been on all their records up to this point. His name was Rob Dean, guitarist Rob Dean. He quit, not because he was mad or anything, because there was no more guitar to be played. David Sylvain wrote all the songs. He's like, there's no guitar. And if there is any guitar, it's going to be rudimentary enough that I'll cover it. And so Rob Dean just walked away. Not like, and it wasn't even like in a dickhead kind of way. It was just like, oh, they're not doing guitars anymore.
Not in the band. I guess I need to go find. So they were a glam band that kind of sucked, you know, as glam, and then became something else.
But you're right. There's no real guitar on this. My only fault on the record is, because now I was going to ask you what you thought about this, it's kind of culturally inappropriate, but there's a lot of like Asian sounding shit on this, and they're called Japan.
If you look on Wikipedia, I think I saw one genre. You know, they tag them with genres like art rock, blah blah blah.
Sure,
one of them was Orientalism. I think I was like, Oriental. You're not allowed to say something.
You can't even say the word Oriental
now. That's not. But it seemed a little culturally
inappropriate.
Off now. It seemed like a little appropriate. Like overly appropriate. I don't know. Is that the word?
Okay, but I was thinking about this, and I don't know who it's because of. Maybe because of Japan, David Bowie not long after did Little China Girl.
I mean,
and then I kept thinking of that other band we covered. I think I'm turning Japanese. But then a pop. I mean, this band does not sound like that. But
making those kind of references wasn't considered insensitive.
No.
Yeah, right. The only, you know, I struggled to be, I will try to be a little critical. I think that there may have been room for some guitar work, maybe.
I think there was. I would have enjoyed it. It also really confirmed for me how much I hated that Oingo Boingo record. Yeah. Because then I was like, oh, this is good. This is really good.
So the guy's name, David Sylvian.
Is it Sylvian? I keep wanting to say Sylvain, but yeah.
I think the reason why could be, isn't that the name of somebody in the New York Dolls?
Yes.
Sylvain.
David Johansson, wasn't he
one of those Sylvain guys
or something before that? Yeah.
And that's not David. That's not his real name. David Sylvain's real name is David Allen Batt. So okay. I feel like he stole the name of the Sylvain guy from the New York Dolls when they were doing glam rock. That's just a theory.
I first started checking into this, I thought like, oh, is this some New York Dolls spinoff because I saw the name David Sylvain.
But, yeah. See, it seems like
Sylvain was the guy in
all right.
New York Dolls.
Obviously, he stole it from somewhere.
Maybe he took David Johansen and Sylvain
and put it seems together. Like every three or four months, my mouth drops open on something.
Right. On an album that we're listening to.
And this is one of them. This was the one where I completely didn't expect it at all. And I can't, I swore that you knew this already.
No. I thought it was a metal band. I'm going to recommend this record. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. It is weird and cool in all the ways that, to me, the early 80s could have been.
And this is, I had moments on this just like when I listened to that Susie Sue album.
Right.
I didn't know these guys even existed.
And now for something completely different, Henry.
And now for something completely different.
What is our next album?
Our next album is Cool in the Gang.
Yeah.
The record we were reviewing this time is called Something Special. And I'm really glad you picked the one song.
I love this song.
This is Get Down On It.
Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. Oh, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down? Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get out? Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get out? Tell me. By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
Tell me, how you gonna do it if you really don't wanna dance? By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
'Cause I heard all the people saying,
get down on it,
come on in.
Henry, is this in your mind too? Is there always this backdrop in the early 80s when you were a kid of these bands that were like the Jackson 5 but weren't the Jackson 5? And it was like it was its own subgenre, like the Commodores, Cool and the Gang, Earth, Wind and Fire. And there's just these like large group, soul group, may or may not play their own instruments.
Okay, so.
And all sing together. Like there's no real like lead singer.
Kind of, because I got Cool and the Gang and Casey and the Sunshine Band. Fucking. I got them confused.
Well, see, for me,
for me,
it was the Commodores and Cool and the Gang. Okay. I couldn't distinguish between Celebration and.
In fact, I had to go look and see if there were any white guys in Cool and the Gang.
Well, but then the one thing that I remember from being a kid then was this guy who was distinctively to me cool. I thought he was cool from Cool and the Gang was JT Taylor. Who, unbeknownst to me, they brought in on the record before this just because they were having trouble singing.
And that ain't the guy.
No, he's not cool.
What did Cool play?
I don't know. Cool played bass or something. I don't know.
I hope he did.
But JT Taylor, to me, was the face of Cool in the Gang. And it blew my mind that these guys had put out a lot of records before this one. They didn't feel comfortable doing ballads because they couldn't find anybody.
This is
to
like
sing
their 15th album.
I know. So like that's just blew
some
my
shit
mind
like that.
So until the album before this, Celebrate, they didn't really have a lead singer. They brought in JT Taylor. He played on sang on four records with them. They went through the roof with songs like Celebration, and then he launched his own. He did his own Lionel Richie and was like, I'm too big for cool.
I did not know that.
Didn't work the same way, but he went out and did his own thing.
So Celebrate was the one that I knew. It was not this one. So, okay, I knew Get Down On It.
Right. That and you was knew the song Celebration from right. Celebrate.
That was like ubiquitous. But this was kind of like that lull record, right?
Well,
they had like the one before this was the big Celebrate. Yes. That was a big one. This was only moderately big. And so.
And I guess I hung out too much at Roller Rink.
Right.
Roller Rink.
You know, there's something fucked up is I hate to bring this guy into it, but I recognize the name of the song, Stepping Out.
Right.
And that didn't come to the front till I heard it. But then I started thinking about this other song called Stepping Out. And it was Joe Jackson.
I know the song you're talking about. Yeah.
Stepping Out. And then that sent me down a Joe Jackson rabbit hole. We're going to listen to his record in next year.
We'll
be this one. So they both had Stepping Out. So anyway, Something Special.
Well, it's interesting. I think this episode, the theme so far this episode is we are way more excited to talk about the artists than any of these particular albums. But here's the thing about this record. I couldn't find anything about it to not like.
That's the problem.
They
followed an arc that seemed to be common. Like you start out with your art rock tendencies, right? At the beginning, their first album was an instrumental, apparently. I didn't listen to it, but that's from what I read. Journey was the same way. They're like Prague,
right?
You know, and eventually they started saying, "Okay, we want to make some money,
right? We need to make some hits.
We need to make some hits." So, you remember they did have like actual commercial success.
Oh, Celebrate. Celebration.
No, like before that, like with greasy funk music, sort of.
Yeah, I mean they were like
Jungle Boogie. That was that band.
Yeah, they were one of those bands like Earth, Wind, and Fire that you knew the name of. You always knew the name of it.
But like the I would have thought that the vocal was handled by somebody in the band. Whoever did the vocal for Jungle Boogie was like their roadie or something.
Yeah, they really struggled vocally, which was amazing to me. Like that's what they auditioned and brought JT Taylor in specifically for ballads.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to do ballads and that nobody felt comfortable singing
them. And so this was a pop record that wasn't bad, but it wasn't their pop peak, I don't believe.
But the only reason, and I listened to the one before, I listened to Celebrate to compare. There's not that much difference, except Celebration is this just massive hit.
Uh-huh.
And this one doesn't have that on it.
Fast forward to like 83 or 84 and go listen to Emergency. You'll be like, these guys are masters.
Right. I'm looking forward to it.
They do.
I actually liked this record, Henry. That's what I was trying to get to. I wanted desperately not to like it.
Yeah. I can't hate it, weirdly. And I think some of it, too, is because this was the soundtrack to like my childhood.
Well, that's
this was actually on the radio.
Did you notice that, too? Like this stuff was like permeating our existence, and I didn't know it. And I'm making a joke, but every little girl in my grade from third grade until sixth grade had skate parties.
Yeah.
And they probably just played this album over and over and over at the skate rink, and I didn't know it. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I just didn't know because I didn't know any of the hits. But, like, listening to this, I felt very comfortable with it. I guess what I was saying, like, it felt like an old shoe. Like,
it's a sound.
It's a sound, yeah.
Familiar to, even if the song you listened to wasn't their hit song.
Right.
It was a familiar sound that you grew up.
And
that
it's a very specific sound to that time period.
Yeah. And if you fast forward, you'll have that same JT
Taylor.
Taylor. James JT Taylor's delivery is the same, but on Emergency, he dirts it up just a little bit to make it better. Apparently Kool and the Gang went through a period where they were too creative, he said. Like they tried to do strings and all kinds of stuff. Can you imagine as a band being given the freedom to make 15 albums without a lot of hits?
Right. I mean, yeah, and that's the 70s, really. Yeah.
Is that even heard of anymore?
Not anymore, yeah. You know, a lot of people, I think Tom Petty said this. If he had come out, started in the early 2000s, there would not be a Tom Petty because he wasn't given the time. I think Bruce Springsteen said that too. If he hadn't been given the time to become Bruce Springsteen, it never would have happened. But these guys, it was interesting to me just because I didn't know – were great musicians. And they, and really, that's what their passion was.
Mm-hmm.
They just, I love how they knew if we're going to have, if we're going to make money, we got to have a badass singer. And I love how the singer guy had the clarity to say, like, sometimes they were just writing too good a song. They needed to just chill the fuck out and write this hit.
Yeah,
that sounds like Steve Perry to me. You know what I mean? Just like, you know, you guys can fuck around with that shit all you want, but if you want a hit,
if
just,
you want a hit,
I got a book full of them.
I'm your Peter Cetera.
Yes,
we're gonna do this like for real. So, I mean, as far as I have to give this sort of a qualified thumbs up. I'm not gonna like scream it from the mountaintops.
I'm putting this right on the cusp of a recommend. It is like right on the. If there was one more rock solid hit,
you I need to. Done a you really need to listen to Emergency.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's coming up. So Henry, what is our last record that we're going to cover here?
The last record we're going to cover is something you are going to introduce.
Okay, it's the Rolling Stones, and the album is Tattoo You. Of course, it was a Rolling Stone 5-star record. Did they ever have a record that wasn't a Rolling Stone 5-star? I don't know. And I'm just going to play it because, I mean, God damn it. This is Start Me Up. Before we do the show, so we never know which way the other guy's going to go.
Right.
So I always there's some albums I look forward to seeing which way you're going to go on the record. So I'm gonna let you start on Tattoo.
I did not know that this album was thrown together, quote unquote.
Yeah,
you wouldn't know that from listening to it.
You could do a whole episode on this on the history of this album. Yeah,
it's so weird.
So the producer on this record, Chris Kimsey,
he just basically threw it together from outtakes.
He should really get as much credit as the Stones, because basically we're going into a period where Jagger and Keith Richards are starting to not like each other, and Jagger kind of at segments when they're trying to put this together is just too busy being Mick Jagger to deal with it. The band blatantly just wanted an album out because they were getting ready to go on a world tour. They weren't jonesing to write a new album.
But
they
to
were
do just, the album.
We need an album.
We need an album, but I don't really want to do one.
Don't really want to do one. So Kimsey goes and calls all the way back. Some of this comes from all the way back from the, you know, early 70s. Finds a bunch of stuff. And here's what I like about it, Henry. It's got this 80s production element to it.
Yeah.
Mixed with these songs, these outtake song, and it's a great record. I love this record. Henry, I owe you an apology. When we covered Some Girls, I went into this thing about how Some Girls is the much better record than Tattoo You. And you were like, fuck you. And I was like, I like this record better than Some Girls. It's really good. I don't know if you picked up on this, but so you've got side A, which is definitively says, we are getting ready to go into a decade where we are stadium rock gods and we're going to make $400 billion. And this is what the shit sounds like. And it's got Start Me Up, you know, which may be the biggest arena rock song of all time.
Right.
Then you've got this second side, which to me is the interesting side, which is this like tired, middle age, we don't really want to do this anymore. Soul weird kind of sound thing going on,
uh-huh.
where guys are coming and going, like on a couple of the songs. My favorite song on the record.
Like that keyboard player guy?
Yeah, and then under my favorite song on the record, really? Keith didn't even show up. It was like Mick and this horn player and Rollins, this famous jazz horn player,
yeah.
And a couple other dudes. And Kimsey said on that session that the heat had gone out on the Paris studio, and he could see Mick's breath in the studio. They were freezing. And he said, Keith just said, fuck it, I'm not showing up. It's just too goddamn cold. And I think the song is great, but to me, side B of this record is the last original great output.
So you're saying
from the Stones before they just said fuck
before
it.
They were fucking Steel Wheels, right?
Yeah, before they just became a money making entity.
The Rolling Stones have always been a dodgy proposition for me. I think I've always disliked Mick Jagger as just a guy. His personality has been kind of off-putting. I never liked that peacock strutting bullshit that he does. And so I have to listen through it. You can't deny that Start Me Up is like a classic song, right? And Waiting on a Friend is a good song.
So, and Waiting on a Friend, too, is like, to me, unintentionally, is the love letter between the two of them to each other. Basically saying goodbye, like that's where the Rolling Stones should have stopped, right there.
Like by all accounts,
if they had stopped right there, they would be not that they already aren't.
I hear what you're saying, and I hadn't really thought of it in that context as being the death of the band, because the next thing you hear from these guys, and it's like love is strong, like this is bullshit.
But the next thing you hear from them is all and it's commodified. Everything is just like we're only doing this because
between a rock and a hard place,
we're wanting to make a lot of money, and we can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So
every time I'm asked to listen to it, you know, I always have to intellectually reestablish why they're good all the time. Because the truth is that I don't really care. Like, I can objectively see that, yes, I mean, I even read the Keith Richards book. I like that, got him as a person. I think he's an interesting person to listen to talk. But my appreciation of them is almost strictly academic.
Which I'm the exact opposite. Like I think they couldn't help but be brilliant at times.
Yeah. Wild Horses is good.
Painted Black is good. All of their 70s records are great. My problem with them is they tarnished everything post Tattoo You is so bad.
Yeah.
And they kept doing it for so long that it kind of, and the band I equate it to is, if REM had stopped before Monster, they would be one of my favorite bands of all time. I now have trouble listening to old REM because in my head,
what they became.
I'm going, what are you saying? What are you playing day after day? And
yeah,
you know,
if he'd stopped strutting around like a peacock and make a showboat of himself, would I have a different, more dignified opinion of this or want to invest in it in a real emotional
and
way?
And I think the other thing, the other thing I think that you personally have always had trouble with the Stones is that they are a blues. Blues is a big part of it. Like,
yeah, and it's kind of hard to.
Sticky Fingers has got blues all over. Mm-hmm. And
when I listen to
it's not your favorite cup of tea.
I feel like I should be wearing Crocs and a fucking Hawaiian shirt.
That's the other problem, which is you equate what they became in the fan base.
Maybe.
With what they are.
Yeah, it's hard to rip those two apart.
Yes, yes. Especially when that's what we grew up with. We grew up in the Steel Wheels era.
Yeah.
My first Rolling Stones concert was on the Steel Wheels tour in Clemson, South Carolina.
In a way, I didn't even have – this is before streaming, right? So I didn't have all this – I didn't have the time to invest in it. I knew this stuff I'd heard on the radio.
Right.
But MTV had – you know, taking a hold of the Rolling Stones and started playing them, and you could see what they looked like for a change and
sure,
all that stuff. And they started to exemplify, I think, in my mind, a lot, you know, this was a very early period of you and I forming a lot of our opinions about music and finding new bands and stuff. And we identified a lot with like underground music, and
yes,
we wanted to be those kinds of people. We didn't want to be these guys. We wanted to be those guys.
But again, I didn't want to be these guys – 5 years from now.
Yeah.
Now looking back, to think that these guys made a record like this in 1980, and they were one of the bands that started rock and roll, like in 65, is pretty incredible. Like that you could make records that actually matter in the same way that I think the Kinks were doing for decades is pretty impressive.
Yeah, but why do I love the Kinks so much more?
Well, I think the post-Tattoo You era of Rolling Stones tarnished a lot for you. And that's the era we grew up in. But again, getting back just to this record, I think there may be not a more iconic start to a song than the beginning riff of Start Me Up.
Right.
Which, I don't know if you saw this in your research, but of course, Keith didn't want it on the record.
He didn't.
And he told Kimsey to erase it. They got to this version of it. It was like they were so exasperated with it, they just did it as a one-off. This was one of Keith's reggae tunes.
Really?
The original versions were always done reggae and with more of a swing to it, and he hated this straightforward version. They actually did this one with the song Miss You from Some Girls in the same session, and it kind of rubbed off on... They kind of were doing it in the style of Mr. You just to be fucking around.
Uh-huh.
And he hated it. And he said, Kimsey said, his quote was, "Every time Keith told me to erase something, I instantly knew that was a keeper."
Erase that.
So, and he attributes a lot of that to that period of time because of Keith's heroin addiction. But he said, yeah, when he told me to erase it, I was definitely like, oh, this is a keeper.
Yeah.
But you have to admit that, like, there might not be a chord change in music that more people know.
Right. I'm sure. Every guitar player knows how to play that. Almost everybody.
I mean, that's just ubiquitous. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, I'm going to recommend Tattoo You. And I don't know. I'm assuming you're not.
Yeah, not. Okay. I don't think I'm going to.
I didn't think. I thought you would actually hate the record. I thought you were going to say.
No, there's plenty of people who will recommend it. I'm just ambivalent.
Okay.
Yeah.
I get you. I'm going to recommend it, but let's go to Megan and see what she has to say. I'm sure she's got some opinions on that replacement record. Probably.
Hey everyone, it's Megan here for your millennial commentary section of the show. The last time I recorded a segment for the show, it was before Christmas, and I had mentioned that I was hoping to get a record player. Well, I have a very exciting update. My lovely boyfriend Nick got me a wonderful record player. It's so cool. You're actually able to like rip vinyl records to CDs on it, and it has input for additional speakers because I love to listen to my music loud. And now I get to finally start buying records again, because when my other record player broke, I kind of took a break from it because I'm like, I can't really even listen to records right now, so why buy more when I already have a huge collection? But anyway, I'm super happy with it, and it's great listening to records again. Sadly, in the music world, we lost Neil Peart on January 7th. He was 67, and apparently he was battling cancer, which I had no idea about. I mean, I'm not a big Rush fan, so I'm not exactly up on like the lives of the band members, but you know, he was a very talented musician, so it's certainly a loss, and you know, my heart goes out to all the Rush fans out there. I know how I feel anytime I've lost an artist that was particularly important to me. So my deepest sympathies on that. My life has been pretty busy. Got a new job. Somebody hit my car and when it was parked and drove off all in the same week. So I started the new job, hit and run. Yeah. But trying to stay positive, and now that my life is calming down a little bit, it's great to be recording again for the show. And this month, we've got some awesome records, one of them being from one of my favorite bands ever, The Replacements. And of course, it's Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash, in August 1981, released on the 25th to be exact. And this was their debut album, and I love this album. I think that it has held up really well. It sounds really fresh and energetic. And I like that they kind of still, even their early stuff, which is known for being way punkier than their later albums, it still has a really good like pop feel to it. And I feel like a lot of like hardcore and punk music from like the early 80s, it's all about like how fast we could play and like very like thrashy. And I like the pop sensibilities of this album. You know, you can't go wrong with songs like Taking a Ride, Customer, Kick Your Door Down is great. So even on this, you know, early album, you can really see the strength of Paul Westerberg's songwriting. He's one of my favorite songwriters. In fact, my friend and I, we were having a little discussion about like the most important songwriters in American history. And of course, you know, Bob Dylan is mentioned, Bruce Springsteen. And then we both agreed, like, we feel that Paul Westerberg is pretty much right up there with Bob and Bruce. And thankfully, the Replacements, especially within the past, I would say like 5 to 7 years, they've really had a resurgence in terms of like, you know, their importance in the music world, especially early alternative. You know, they were really one of the earliest bands, I would say, that got some popularity. Unfortunately for them, they kind of fell apart and, you know, maybe weren't able to see their full potential into fruition. But I love the Replacements. Every album is great. As we continue on into the 80s and beyond, who knows? We'll probably be talking about Replacements albums again. I'm probably going to be pushing it a little bit too. Like, I'm definitely, you know, I want to talk about even their later stuff, like Don't Tell a Soul. That's such a great record. So this record I have to recommend, obviously, for this month. This is my pick. Although I do like Tattoo You by the Rolling Stones. That one is great. And I think that kind of like some people look down on it. Or at least look down on the Stones for it, because it was definitely like, I mean, they were trying to get into the commercial, like MTV stuff of the early 80s. So, and I think that record's awesome though. So definitely would recommend. Anyway, so now for the social medias and stuff, because that's what people in my age group are good at, right? So, of course, we're on Twitter at 80s Exposed, on Instagram at 80s374. And then 80s Music Exposed on Facebook, and then Patreon as well. And if you want to shoot Henry and Chris an email, they'd be more than happy to chat with you. 80smusicexposed@gmail.com. Of course, we'd love to hear from you, so definitely feel free to comment or share stuff. You know, that'd be great. You can also follow me on social media if you want. I'm at BastardsOfYoung92 on Instagram. See, I wasn't joking about me being a Replacements fan. Or Megan Maddox on Facebook. And if I don't respond to your friend request or follow request, it might just be because we don't have any mutual friends, and I don't always accept a random friend request. So if you're a listener of the show and you send me one and I don't respond to it, maybe just shoot me a message and I'll totally accept it then, just because it's cool to talk to you guys. So thank you so much for listening. Definitely rate and review us. If you enjoy, download the show on Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to your podcast. So thank you so much, and stay rad.
Okay, Henry, so that's part two of August of 1981.
And that's the way it is.
That's the way it is. What is your overall recommend for the second half of August 1981?
Japan, 10 drums.
10 drum, that is your...
Everybody needs to hear this, man. If you like this kind of music, like if you liked 80s sort of underground art rock, you probably haven't heard this. I mean...
And I thought it was a metal band, so I was really
so good on surprise. You, Megan. Damn.
But you know what, Henry? I'm not going to pick this one. I'm not going to pick that one just because I don't like when we pick the same record.
Yeah.
I'm picking "Tattoo You" by Rolling Stone. I think that is as near to canon.
No, man.
As I can get without it being canon.
My record is canon, based on your thing. Think about it. Listen to that.
You know what the beauty of canon is? You get to make your own candy, but it ain't on my candy. But yeah, I'm gonna recommend Tattoo. And Henry, next month is only a single episode month, so they're only covering 5 records from September.
We get to march a little farther down.
That's right. And the records we're gonna cover are by Cabaret Voltaire, Hall and Oates, Mariana Faithful. I'm looking forward to that one. Depeche Mode and Genesis.
This is the second Hall and Oates record we're listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Hall and Oates.
I'm hoping I like this one a lot better than the other one.
I think I liked it. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Many thanks to our show producer, Greg Levin. If you like the way we sound, you can talk to him at Urban Dweller on Instagram, URBNDWELLR on Instagram, or at NBC Greg on Twitter. We're thankful to have him on our team.
And many thanks to Megan Maddox, our social media maven. So if you want to start a social media argument with us, you will probably be arguing with her.
And Chris, guess what?
What's that, honey?
I made you a mixtape.